Recently, my wife Marianne and I were in Europe. It was a memorable trip for a lot of reasons. The people, the cities, the architecture, the churches and of the buildings, the lifestyles of the people in the European port cities, the languages, the different styles of clothing, behaviors, all sorts of things like that made it very interesting to us. One of the stops on the trip was to St. Petersburg, Russia. Russia, as most of us know, has been promoted for the last 60 years as the arch enemy of the United States. As we went to St. Petersburg, one of the things that we quickly learned was that St. Petersburg was named after the Apostle Peter. So that was kind of interesting. I'm certain that in the United States, just like in Russia, the other people were portrayed as the bad guys. In the United States, we saw Russians as the bad guys and ourselves as the good guys. And in Russia, no doubt, they were painted as the good guys, whereas the people of America were painted as the bad guys. We did a couple of different things on our tour of St. Petersburg, one of which was to take a boat ride through the canals of the city. And it was amazing. It's just an amazing city. And it was very easy to go into admiration. You could admire the people, you could admire the fact that they built that city and the canals. And since Marianne and I both come from a small seaport on the eastern end of Long Island, we have an affinity for the seaports, the water, that sort of thing. And to look at the canals and the stones put in place on either side of the canals to make the literal canal itself was unbelievable. I have brothers in marine construction business back on Long Island, and they don't use stone, they use metal and they use wood to create docks and bulkheads and jetties and marinas and stuff. But to see a construction on this level done a century or more ago, it was absolutely astonishing. Because of all of the canals and the beauty involved in that, St. Petersburg is oftentimes referred to as the Venice of the North. Having been in Venice, which is an amazing place as well, you can, from a construction standpoint, quickly go into admiration for the way the Russians have built that city. I found a lot of things very difficult to believe about St. Petersburg specifically and about Russia in general. I found it hard to believe that our enemy has the largest art museum in the world called the Hermitage. I thought, how can our enemy be interested in art museums? That's not the portrait that was painted when we were children or even up to yesterday, that these people would be interested in things like art and culture and museums and other things, just like we are. Another stop on our tour was when we visited the Church of the Savior on Spilled Blood, which is the largest mosaic artwork in the world. It's just, if I say unbelievable, it's actually not only unbelievable, but it's indescribable. These mosaics, 7,500 square meters of mosaics throughout the church, they're depicting all the people that we would have learned about from our early Christian education, you know, all the saints and all the people participating in biblical stories and all the events in Christianity. It just was mind-boggling. And I thought, in this fantastic church, how could this enemy honor the same saints, Jesus, and the same God that we do? How is that possible? Well, after a fairly lengthy time in the church, with our heads spinning, we came out of the church and stepped into the sunshine of St. Petersburg to do some people watching. There were tourists all over the place and Russians, everybody mingling. No conflicts, no challenges, no warfare, no attitudes. One of the things that we were looking for is ice cream, because Marianne had been told by a friend here in the United States that one of the treats that you want to offer yourself when you get to St. Petersburg is to find a street vendor who sells ice cream. You will absolutely love it. It's a great experience. Well, we looked around for those street vendors. We found street vendors, but none of them had ice cream. And apparently that was totally consumed by everybody that beat us to the punch. Looking around, though, at just an amazing amount of beautiful people, beautiful women, beautiful children, beautiful men, young couples holding hands, walking, talking, as young couples will do, people hurrying to and from work, parents pushing baby carriages, old people ambling up and down the sidewalks, making their way to stores perhaps or back to their apartments. I kept having the same question in my mind, repeating over and over again. How can these people be my enemy? How can these people be my enemy? They look just like us. They act just like us. They sound a bit different because they're speaking different languages. But above and beyond that, we seem to be the same. I would imagine if anybody was thinking along those same lines, they were looking at us and thinking, gee, they don't look like they're our enemies. Americans don't appear to be our enemies. They look pretty much just the way we do. And maybe they speak a little bit differently, but above and beyond that, they seem to be just like us. After I was pondering that question multiple times, this other one popped in my mind. Who is telling me the Russians are my enemy? Who's telling me that? And another question, who is benefiting from us having the Russians as our enemy? Most of us above the age of reason have heard the statement, follow the money. If you want to understand what's going on, follow the money. And sometimes that seems a little bit cynical, but as a rule of thumb, it can be pretty helpful. Follow the money. And so, somebody benefiting from us having Russians as the enemy and perhaps having Americans as enemy is benefiting a certain group of Russians. In theory, we identify threats as enemy in order to increase our chances of survival. If we were cave people and we were heard the growling of a saber-toothed tiger outside, it would pay for us to pretty quickly be able to identify that as an enemy. And those in our clan, for instance, that were successful at identifying that enemy were the ones most likely to survive. Those that thought it was an interesting sound, let's check it out, perhaps ended up on the menu of one of those saber-toothed tigers. It certainly can help us to know that something can harm us so that we can prevent that harm by various means. Various means can range from communicating, to fighting, to running away, and all kinds of variations of those three different approaches. An important thing happens when a person is labeled as the enemy. That is, when a person or a people is labeled as the enemy. On an individual level, that is, a single person labels something or someone as the enemy, the resources of that person's body are reorganized for the purposes of self-protection, not growth. Thinking speed suffers, while reaction speed increases. Said another way, when we perceive an enemy, we are voting for reacting and voting against thinking. We are voting for primitive actions, and we are voting against the use of wisdom. We give up our intellectual power and submit to the power of our instincts. in an actual emergency, you can imagine if our instincts trigger and they happen really quickly, that can be excellent, because those things can be amazingly fast. But as a way of life, creating enemy is a way of death, because it causes that reallocation of resources in the body, and self-protection is, on the short term, a valuable approach, but on the long term, it prevents growth, and over time, causes illness and dysfunction, disease, and then ultimately death. To shift from an individual scale to a larger scale, the promotion of the existence of an enemy has similar but even more dangerous results. Because of the reallocation of resources away from growth-related activities to protection activities, this is and can be highly profitable for the people who are controlling that process. And in large cases, those are corporations, peopled by individuals that are benefiting from that consolidation of power and control and giving direction and purposes to this level of enmity that they're promoting. The trouble for the group, those of us outside of that power elite, is that we become dumber, more reactive, and more fear-based. Now, really what happens, and you can see this historically, in times of trouble, droughts, high unemployment, etc., etc., the demagogues, the power consolidators, the manipulators, the controllers of the media, will start to herd people like they're cattle, but using fear, and they herd them in a particular direction, and then they define the enemy in such a way as to make the next action be anger-oriented. And they turn that anger into a specific direction, and now it leads to attack and war. We don't have to go very far in human history to be able to identify what happened after World War I with the disempowerment of Germany due to the treaties, and then the demagogues, Hitler and friends, who then started to preach fear and preach superiority and so on. Ultimately, they defined the target for the anger and turned on Jews, Catholics, gypsies, homosexuals, anybody else that they saw as a threat to their consolidation of power. So who gets to label people as enemies? Anybody willing to scream it, whisper it, gossip it, preach it, teach it, talk about it on television or radio, or in newspapers, magazines, emails, and on blogs. If you think about this a little bit more, it becomes clearer that the people willing to be loud and the people with access to channels of communication, such as the media and the internet, are the ones who hand the rest of us pre-labeled enemies. And they're plentiful. They're plentiful. And so when you look at who is a pre-labeled enemy, you recognize there are plenty to go around. The specific type of enemy that happens to be promoted depends on what kind of conflicts we've been exposed to or have been normalized in our experiences. We make these conflicts so normal, even though they're, you could look at them and say, well, I think I can make the case that they're abnormal, but in fact they're so common that we think they're normal. For example, if I were to give you a category of people, it would be very clear, almost instantaneously, the category of the enemy that was associated with the first. Just by defining one group, we could see the other group that typically is in conflict. If I use this example, if I said a Southerner in the United States, pretty quickly people would get the established enemy could be called a Northerner. If I said a Protestant in Northern Ireland, the conflicting party that is the enemy would be labeled by most people in that area as a Catholic. A Southern black, we'd probably end up with a Southern white. That Muslim would probably conceive of a Christian or a Jew as the enemy. If I said a Jew, that Jew would probably conceive of a Muslim or Christian as the enemy. A New York Yankees fan, to make it a little less intense, would probably see the Boston Red Sox fan as the enemy, and vice versa. A Republican would see a Democrat as an enemy. A Democrat would see the Republican as an enemy. A black would see a white, and a white would see a black. A capitalist would see a communist as an enemy. And it can go on and on. In the early 1970s, I was in the United States military in Latin America. My college degree is in history, with an emphasis on Latin American history. Thanks to the U.S. Army, I speak Spanish. I have a high degree of affinity for Hispanics, and I have since I was a little child. I don't know why, since no one in my family spoke Spanish. We didn't have any Spanish-speaking friends, and frankly, we were as white as you could get, and prejudiced to boot. But nonetheless, I recognized this affinity for Hispanics. And when I had the opportunity to learn Spanish and live in Latin America, I jumped at that chance. In my work in Latin America, I was responsible for coordinating military training teams or mobile training teams that went from the Canal Zone, controlled by the United States, into Latin American countries to help train the military or the police or civilian health projects. During that time, about 4 years, I noticed that the labeling of the enemy was pretty consistent. The people who had previously consolidated power, wealth, land, influence, were the people who were in a position to do the labeling. And frankly, way before I ever got to Latin America, those people were defined in publications as the haves, meaning they had it. They had things, power and so on. And they were able to describe the poor people, who were labeled as have-nots in English, those people who wanted education, who wanted health care for their children, who wanted an opportunity to grow food for their families, who wanted an opportunity for better lives for their families. Those people were labeled by the haves as communists. Back in the day, in the 60s and the 70s, and even up till a minute ago, once a group is labeled as another group, by another group as a communist threat, there's a knee-jerk reaction that takes place in the United States government that causes us as a country to provide a huge amount of money and weapons and military training and all kinds of support in order to protect the holdings of the haves. That is, we go into protection of the haves and their properties. The question is, why? Because our corporations are so firmly and profitably connected to the haves that we do it in our own self-interest. Instead of seeing the have-nots as displaying a normal and natural response to imbalance, an incredible imbalance at that, it's seen as an action of an enemy. Death squads in El Salvador, for instance, murdered families who demanded justice, land, education, health care, food, and the United States funded it, despite the efforts of well-intentioned people, to include even the United States ambassador during that time, Robert White. In the United States, if somebody wanted to level the playing field, we would think that is so typically American, that is so U.S., that is so noble, that is so great, that is so wonderful. However, when it starts to occur outside of the United States and it jeopardizes the pocketbooks of the have corporations, now all of a sudden, that noble spirit to growth and protection and helping the family develop is seen as a work of an enemy. In 1974, at the end of the year, I drove from Panama back to the United States, and in order to go on the Pan-American Highway, you do drive through a variety of countries. Driving through Nicaragua on the way back to the U.S., I was absolutely astonished to notice over and over that there were what appeared to be hundreds of thousands of acres of cotton fields on either side of the Pan-American Highway with huge signs saying it was owned by Somoza family and a United States cotton corporation. That is, the power, the land, the profits were so strongly consolidated and concentrated into the hands of a dictator that we put in place, the United States literally put in place his family and supported him and protected him and a corporation. Just unbelievable. And you can recognize in Nicaragua, even up until this today, that the real challenge in the eyes of the media in the United States is the battle is between the communists or Sandinistas or left-leaning bad guys, read have-nots, and the good guys, the haves, the puppets of the United States, the corporations of the United States. And this has led to years and years of unrest and hardship. This has led to years and years of hardship and unrest in Nicaragua. If we could have asked, historically, from the early 1900s to today, people in different eras in Nicaragua, who they thought the enemy of Nicaragua was, the top answer would have been from the early 1900s till a minute ago, the United States, followed by the second choice, which would have been the dictators put in place by the United States. United States citizens were not and are not the enemy of the people of Nicaragua, or Russia for that matter. United States corporations, politicians, generals are the enemies because they conspire to keep the playing field unlevel, divided into those two groups, the highly advantaged have and the highly disadvantaged have-nots. Isn't it odd, because this question has me shaking my head on a regular basis, that the greatest leveler of the playing field the world has ever known, Jesus Christ, has so many people claiming to follow him, but who are absolutely committed to keeping the playing field unlevel. And those of us that fall into that category, instead of labeling ourselves as Christians, we might be more accurate if we labeled ourselves as Romans, Pharisees, Sanhedrin, Sadducees, or any other names that were appropriate for the people interested in consolidating power to themselves while disempowering others. So how would we define an enemy? I think this is a personal, moral, and ethical decision that everybody needs to make for themselves. But I'm going to share my opinion. As you already know, if you've listened to any of these calls, I think thinking for ourselves, using our imagination, the great gift that God has given us, is so important to our development as spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical beings that it's an individual choice, thinking for ourselves. If I draw a horizontal line, and this is going to be how to define an enemy, if I draw a horizontal line, on the far right I write the word God, and on the far left I write a hyphenated word, not hyphen God, not God. That would be my starting point. I would say that anyone or anything encouraging my movement toward God would be considered a friend. And anybody promoting or encouraging or inciting my movement toward the lower vibrations, that is, toward the not God end, would not be a friend, would be more on the level of enemy. I would say anybody opposed to balance would be an enemy. Anybody opposed to understanding, justice, acceptance, and harmony would be an enemy. Anyone who incites fear and hatred and non-thinking would be an enemy. Anybody opposed to the spreading of fairness, power, and influence would be an enemy. Anyone who demonizes, destroys, or disempowers others would be the enemy. Who would be a friend? Someone who promotes yours and my movement on that horizontal line toward the God end. According to your definition of God, not my definition of God, toward your definition of God. How could you be a friend? How could I be a friend? We could promote another person's movement toward their own definition of God. This is what I think is the ultimate act of enmity. Believing that we make ourselves safe by creating enemies. I think we're safe from enemies when we accept that balance is the remedy for conflict. Until we, individually, personally, in our thoughts and in our actions, and in our talk, recognize this. We are the enemy. You can imagine that when you're on a cruise, like Marianne and I were, that one of the things you notice is the water. One day I was explaining an idea that occurred to me as I was journaling one morning. That is, I imagined the water having four different levels of roughness or turbulence or turmoil or stress, if you will. I saw the sea, the body of water, could be a pond, could be a lake, could be the Baltic Sea, which is where we were, or the North Sea, which we were. You could see it as very rough, whatever that means to you. Then you could see it as moderately rough, and then moderately calm. And then the fourth version would be very calm, almost like glass. Right? And so you can imagine having the bodies of water very rough down to very calm. And I just made up four. Could be less, could be more. It doesn't really matter. But that seemed like a convenient number for my thinking at that moment. And I would say, you know what? It's clear to me, and this is no great insight on my part, I've learned this, that we are between 75 and 85% water, so we in fact are like the sea. The saline content of our blood is very similar to seawater. We are like the sea. Okay, so we've got these four varieties of calmness or roughness, from very calm to very rough. I like the definition of stress defined by Hans Selye, the father of modern investigation into stress, said that stress was the nonspecific response, to a demand placed upon the body. When that demand is placed upon the body and the body doesn't have a specific response, it is conceived of as a threat. That threat is conceived of as an enemy. I noticed this during the cruise, that when I was thinking about something to which I had a non-specific response, that is a work-related thing that needed to be done, but I wasn't really in a position to do it without internet access or telephone access and so on. What did I do? The thought that occurred to me is to calm my sea. So I imagined myself going from the very rough, staticky, stressed version, and then calming myself down until I got very calm, still as glass. And then I determined my specific response. I turned over the responsibility for handling that demand to my friend, capital F, God. I handed it over to God. I wasn't in a position to do anything about it. I wasn't going to be able to handle it. I knew that. And when it occurred to me, I calmed myself down and asked God to handle it. So I did that multiple times. And if you've ever been on a cruise, that you know that one of the great things about a cruise is the sleeping. It is literally, when you're on board, that is the most fun, most rewarding, most, perhaps the healthiest thing that you can be doing, is to be sleeping. So over the course of our sea days and so long, we would take 2 or 3 naps. It was absolutely fantastic. And so as I was falling asleep or getting either in a napping situation or at night, and if something was causing my sea to be in turmoil, I would calm myself down and ask God to handle it for me. And if there was something I needed to do the next day, if that were clear to me, I would do what I could do. I handed it over to my friend, ever present, ever supportive, ever available, ever helpful, friend, God. So I described this to Marianne a couple of times, and she thought about it and wasn't overly impressed with the idea. So that was okay. I just had written about it, and I wanted to verbalize it. On our way home, flying from Holland back to the United States, Marianne was telling me that her shoulder was extremely painful. This is kind of an ongoing chronic condition. She's had chiropractic adjustments and massage and so on, but today in the plane, it was really, really hurting her. She said, I have a high tolerance for pain, but this is really, really bad news. This is very problematic. There was really nothing for me to do. But a little while later, she said, I have to tell you something. You know that thing you were talking about calming the sea and going from the rough, turbulent, staticky, stressful sea to calm, and then asking God to help? I said, sure. I did that with my shoulder. I said, okay. She absolutely unbelievable. The pain instantly diminished. It instantly diminished. I've been in pain for hours, and after I did that, it instantly diminished. Now, I know it's still there. I know whatever problem is there is there, but I'm not uncomfortable. I'm not in agony. That idea has such power. And to me, really, to be able to know that we have a relationship with a friend like this that can help us surmount, deal with, handle any stress, any threat, any perceived situation of enmity, just makes the need for conflict, makes the need for war absolutely non-essential. We have that power. We have that power. It can't be consolidated away from us. That power of our relationship with our friend, our God. If we'll take responsibility for it and recognize it is our right, it has always been ours, we can know our friend. I'd like to end this service with a prayer. Father God, Mother God, Christ, the Creator and connection to all that is, thank you for being our friend. Thank you for helping us to become aware of that, so we don't tremble in fear at the thought of you punishing, hurting, or denying us, but in fact, helping us to know that you are ever-present, loving, caring, supporting, coming to our aid, calming us, comforting us, helping us, healing us. Help us to know that just by choosing to align with you, the stream of healing spirit is ours to bathe in. Anytime, all the time. Thank you for that gift. It is so. Amen.